Hey.
Hey, good morning.
So I'm not sure which one of us is supposed to be the provocateur, but
no, you're distinguished. I'm the provocateur.
All right, so you're...
That's what he said.
You can ask the provocative questions. And the, we got about 45 minutes here, and okay. We want to sort of run through basically how do we transform government from front to back? What are the big obstacles? What are the opportunities?
Okay, what are we going to do with the other 20 minutes then?
And then what are we going to do with the other 20 minutes? So to start with, I come from a world right now where we work with thousands of startups that are kind of tackling traditionally public sector problems, education, health, energy, areas like this. And, it's really, really fascinating to kind of look at the differences in how sort of startups attack problems versus the way the federal government agencies traditionally do. And I think the thing that's most fascinating is sort of this focus on the customer. Right? Not just agile development, but agile development with this unbelievable laser-like emphasis on the customer experience. How do you deliver something that is really, really compelling? What are the implications of that for how government agencies need to sort of transform and deliver kind of in response to this transformed expectation that citizens have?
Well, I think there's a lot we can learn from the startup phenomenon. But I think the most important one, and if I were in that last panel and got that last question, I'd say the one most important thing that I would want to see brought to any effort in government is urgency. And I heard, I think it was Michelle who said, why is it then when we have a big problem, when we have an emergency, we're fighting a war, we're able to find the capacity and the solutions to these incredibly complex problems? And there's no better problem solver in the world, frankly, than the US government. If there is some insurmountable challenge, like getting someone to the moon or saving freedom for the world, we know how to do it. The question is, why don't we bring that same kind of urgency and sense of mission every day to the work that we do? And part of it is because we're mousetrapped by, you heard about the FAR and you heard about the oversight authorities and the concern about regulation. I think our biggest challenge is figuring out how to deal with risk. And how to give people the opportunity to engage in a little bit of risk, take that risk, experiment with it, see what the outcome is. And that really is the fundamental underpinnings of a startup. It's that initial risk that someone goes in and said, look, I think I have a better way to do this. They take a chance at it, they experiment with it, maybe they pivot, and they move towards an outcome. I think the other point you made was that laser-like focus on customer. And that's something that we have to bring in to everything we do, and not just to talk about it, but actually to really figure out who are our customers, how do we serve them, and how do we give them the best possible outcome.
Yeah, I did my first startup in 1996, and I think we'd spent about $7, $8 million before we had a real product with a market, customers using it. And I think it was about a 35-person development team. With the kinds of, roll forward, 15, 16 years later, with the kinds of startups we're investing in now, literally the cost of that process is dropped by at least 10x, right? So if a startup can't get there for $600,000 or $700,000 with a 2 or 3 person team, they're not even in the game anymore. And yet it doesn't feel like that, anywhere close to that sort of transformative power of technology is kind of filtered through into the way government's solving problems.
No, I think that's right. I think what you've described there is some corollary of Moore's law. Mm-hmm. There's the fact that the cost of computing has come way down, the cost of storage has come way down. I was talking with some folks in Silicon Valley, they've said the cost of programming has come way down. Yeah. Things like GitHub and the fact that people are able to use quality code and fork it over to their projects. The best projects are the ones that are built with other people's code. That has driven down the cost of delivering great outcomes. We suffer in government often from something that's called Baumol's disease, and that's the inability for technology to actually yield progress.
Right.
I think you see green shoots, and you heard about it in the last panel. I think you've heard about it throughout this whole conversation. There's a huge amount of frustration about the fact that people know that there's something vastly better in the way of technology, in the way of outcomes, available to them. They can reach into their pocket and pull out a world that's very different than the one they're operating in, oftentimes in their government agencies, and they're going to demand. They want that better outcome. And so I think we're in that interesting period of time where we're trying to figure our way through to to get some of the benefits of Moore's Law and its corollary.
So I think there's obviously the Moore's Law, as you just talk about, the cost of programming has collapsed, the cost of storage, the cost of connectivity, all of that's down. But I think there's something else as well that's really central, and in the startup world now, it's kind of referred to as the lean startup methodology. The way I often describe it is that startups have figured out that approaching a problem as an engineer is much less effective than approaching a problem as a scientist. Mm-hmm. In other words, an engineer starts from the premise of I'm gonna go out, analyze the problem, create this blueprint, which they call a business plan, and they define it in great depth, and then they work backwards and say, what are all the things I need to do to get to that business plan? And they go out and they build their company. And the problem, right, is that what investors and smart startup people have sort of figured out is that the odds are approaching 100% that business plan is wrong.
Right.
Right, and so you waste a lot of capital, you waste a lot of time, and that sort of approach has really gone out of favor towards one where you're viewing it more as a scientist, which is you don't really know when you start out what the solution is, what it looks like, and it's much more about forming a hypothesis of how you can solve this problem for a given customer.
But could you imagine saying that at an appropriations hearing?
No, I can't. Yeah,
and so that's the problem. We work in a world in which there's certain expectations, including the Form 300 process, the appropriations process, the oversight process, that really militates towards the waterfall. Look, we spent 20 years learning how to do the waterfall. We've built agencies and consultancies around waterfalling. And now everyone shows up and say, okay, that's out. Agile. Do it agilely. And so I think part of the thing we have to recognize is, as Yogi Berra said, Rome wasn't burnt in a day. So it took a while for it to get like this. We're going to have to figure out ways to pivot. Now, yep. The trick to pivoting is actually demonstrating that you can do it. You know, people have just barely gotten comfortable that there is a path through the waterfall, and we're saying we need a different path. So I think that's why it's important for us to have started groups like 18F,
yeah,
which actually go and help the agencies at little bits and bytes period, levels, and let them bite off little things, let them see things, let's kind of experiment and demonstrate that you can get there. I'm excited about the fact that that will give people then the confidence to take the risk to start moving a bigger, higher value efforts into that kind of approach.
So let's dig into 18F a little bit more. So in your mind, what in your sort of big vision, like what is the role that 18F is going to play in transforming the way government does business?
Well, 18F has done an awful lot in helping us transform the way we're doing kind of internal business. We joke a lot that 18F, if nothing else, if it were to end tomorrow, at least it taught us how to hire people faster. And that's not what we set out to do. It wasn't, it wasn't the HR office. But by applying these approaches, these agile approaches to even basic business processes, we've gotten better at doing something as simple or as straightforward as hiring folks. We're hoping that we can show people that model and that they can learn from it too. We're hoping that actually by having people who know how to code, who know how to design, who really are thoughtful about business process and the application of technology to it, that we can be a better consumer of information technology resources and that we can share that experience with other agencies so that they can be better consumers.
So in other words, if I could restate, the rest of GSA is learning how to buy technology in a different way from working with 18F, which is building technology in a different way. And those lessons can then be taken out.
And not just GSA, and I think that that's the really important thing, that we not think about these as little island nations, mm-hmm, Hawaii notwithstanding, sunny, that we are really, we are one big entity, and that the biggest value we're going to get is by really leveraging that scale, by doing things once and well, rather than doing them over and over again.
So let's kind of take the 18F and put it aside for a second. So what are some of these other big barriers that are preventing operating in this more agile, customer-focused way?
I think one of the big barriers is this sense that the agencies really are these kind of mm-hmm, separate principalities. It's kind of like Italy before Garibaldi. They're all their own separate little fiefdoms, even within the agencies. The bureaus can be incredibly strong and incredibly insular. And what happens then is we invest repeatedly in the simple and the straightforward stuff. We invest repeatedly in the utility, and as a result, we don't leave as much resource for innovation that we should have. We don't leave as much resource for actual direct customer service or mission-specific activities that we should have. And I think that that's one of our, I think our real big going forward challenge is figuring out the way that we can take all the smart people, and there are lots of smart people spread throughout the entire organization, and figure out a way to deconflict the things that they're doing, you know, on top of each other, and then figure out where they can provide their specific value add, and so we can benefit from that. And I think that's the bigger, that's a really big challenge, because agencies, it's repeated by the way the budget structure is, it's repeated by the Hill oversight, because that's aligned around agencies, and what it does is really militates towards us being very atomized, when we could be, frankly, much more focused.
So how do you sort of break through a lot of those reinforced institutional kind of boundaries?
I think we're beginning to do it already just through just the power of transparency and the fact that, you know, events like this have people begin to cross-pollinate. Resource constraint is forcing people to ask, are there other ways that we can do this? Efforts like the one that Beth Cobert talked about around benchmarking, which shows people, you know, what their actual cost of service is and what the relative cost of service is, what the average cost of service is, so we can begin to try to put some pressure on it. I think those are all part of the technique to doing it. I think we, as the General Services Administration, as a cross-agency entity, we have a responsibility to really facilitate that space. So our consolidated acquisition platform is a great example of where we're trying to actually bring the data from the agencies together into one place, so that agencies can see how other agencies are buying things. And in essence, we have to almost create the internet of acquisition. It's striking to me how you can go onto the web and you can look up almost anything, but you can't look up the contracts that various agencies have. So I don't know what's happening in VA versus EPA versus DOI. I do know at the end that we are repeatedly contracting with the same people, oftentimes for the exact same things. And that's costing us money to go out into the community to seek that bid, and it's costing them money to go and bid on it.
A lot of this is sort of how do we make the federal government operate in a more agile, startup-y way. But in the other direction, right, it's incredibly difficult for the startups that we work with to even contemplate selling anything to the federal government. Right, the barriers are so high, and one of the biggest complaints is that they're looking for reputable markets.
Right?
We have a lot of startups that sell into state and local because you can go and sell the same solutions to lots of different stuff. In the federal government, every agency is essentially asking for a custom solution.
Right?
Everything is sort of defined so that what this agency needs is different from that agency. How do you sort of go about harmonizing that, aligning that? Is it a solvable problem?
Well, and I think we, again, Michelle talked about prescriptive and descriptive. I think that we default to prescriptive. I think we default to agency specific. And I think in part is because each agency is going out and acquiring oftentimes individually that solution. So I really think the question is, in this idea of leveraging shared services, are there shared opportunities for us to buy as one? Mm-hmm. The strategic sourcing initiative was one kind of approach to that. We think the consolidated acquisition platform, where we actually provide all the information so people can see what other folks are buying, they can see what other people's contracts are, they can either leverage that vehicle or copy the vehicle and act like the coder of today. Instead of saying, look, I'm going to start from scratch and write this code, why not go and take something that's tested and proven and actually delivers an outcome you can at least go and talk to someone about?
You know, if you're starting up a new business today and you want to scale quickly, you're basically going to go, do I want to be on Gmail or do I want to be on Office 365? Do I want to be on Stripe or do I want to be on QuickBooks Online? There's just a standard set of constantly evolving tools that you can use that you don't even think about that stuff anymore. It's just taken care of for you. Is it ultimately, to some extent, once you get past all of the rest of this, almost that simple of, does government even need to be in the email business anymore?
No, we shouldn't be in the email business in the sense of actually building email systems. I don't think that each agency and each bureau and each subcomponent of a bureau should be busy going out and contracting for their own email either. Someone talked about 17 different email systems. As a treasury, we had 10. And if the secretary wanted to send out a message, we actually had to send a message to the email manager to send the message to one particular bureau. That shouldn't exist. That shouldn't have existed 10 years ago. I don't know why it existed 3 years ago. So what we need to do is, again, capture that sense of urgency and say there is no award for being the agency CIO with the most number of email systems, right? I mean, and there's really no award for being the bureau.
The American Association of Email Vendors may have that award.
No, I don't know if they do, actually. It must be kind of annoying to them to sell many, many, many instances of the same thing and then try to figure out how to balance the evolution. So I think really if we could start moving towards this idea, and maybe Fatara helps, we just did it in GSA by saying our CIO is our CIO. And all the other people who are working on IT have to report to that CIO. And then Sunny is our, Sunny Hashmi, it was Casey Coleman before, they are our, they're our leader in establishing kind of the architecture for the system, mm-hmm. for the organization. And the trick for GSA was to get to one system, one approach, so that we could start forgetting about email and start thinking more about how we deliver those more important services that are core to our mission. And I think that that's what we should be thinking about across the government. Figure out those services that are utilities, treat them as utilities, find the agencies that deliver them well. We're working with a number of agencies to hand over things like financial management or HR management, because that's not our mission. GSA's job isn't to be a financial manager. Our job is to provide buildings, to provide acquisition, and provide technology.
Yeah, so email's obviously a somewhat obvious example, right? But move up a level. How many grants management systems does the federal government need?
I can honestly say I have no idea how many it has. It probably
hundreds, thousands?
Yeah, and in some cases, it probably where it needs them, it doesn't have any.
Right.
So that I think is a I know from my experience in state and local government in the District of Columbia, one of the ways we really got control over the operations in the District of Columbia was really solidifying around a single acquisition system, a single HR system, and a single financial management system. I think the federal government is too big for that kind of singularity, and that would require us to go in perhaps too deep into one set of vendors. But we shouldn't have the completely a navigable forest that we have today of these systems, because it makes it impossible for us to really get a sense of what we're spending our money on, who's winning the contracts, who's not, where the best value is.
So going back to some of your experience with DC, there was a lot of talk about in the earlier panel about sort of getting closer to the citizen and facing the citizen. But one of the reasons why a lot of our startups focus on municipal governments and state governments is that actually, that's where a whole lot of the citizen-facing aspect of government is. There's actually a lot less that the federal government is doing. How does the federal government engage the citizen when so much of what it does is intermediated?
I'm going to push back on that a little bit in a second, but let me agree first and say that there's much more citizen accountability at the state and local level. I spent 6 years in Chicago, and it's an article of faith that Mayor Belandic did not win that election because he didn't plow the snow after that snowstorm, right? There is a direct electoral consequence of failing to deliver citizen service at the state and local level. It's much more attenuated at the federal level. But I will tell you, the federal government does deal directly with citizens at a scale that blows away any state and local government. I mean, if you think about it, the TSA will probably interact with more citizens today than any other place other than the state of California or New York. And so we do actually have a very direct citizen focus. Even the things that are one step removed have a direct impact on citizens. FAA, USDA meat inspection. Man, you want that to go right. border control. So I actually think that there is an awful lot we can learn from that kind of intense citizen service focus that you've seen at the state and local level apply it to our federal agencies.
Yeah. It, no, absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's still challenging when you think in that context, though, is that, you know, in our lives as consumers, we're being trained for everything to be is more and more responsive to us, more and more on demand, right? We can sit here with this thing and
Right. Everything
just appears with us. And if we're displeased, our capacity to provide feedback and reviews and Right. Have that feed
give
into
it
the
a
system.
Thumbs down.
Yeah, and then, you know, the example I always use personally, my wife's Russian. And truly, I feel like I lost 2 years of my life in this weird Kafka-esque maze of going through the process of getting her a visa, right? Mm-hmm. It was truly one of the most bizarre Byzantine experiences, and it feels like a lot of these federal processes are still just very, very disremoved from the idea that they're supposed to be immediately responsive, that feedback should deliver into it. Is that a cultural issue? I mean, is it fundamentally an issue of trying to change the culture of these agencies? Is it a technology issue?
Right. I don't think there's anyone in the State Department or DHS who's waking up in the morning and say, how can I be more like Kafka today? Even if it
feels
gives your wife some sense of her former homeland. But
it does, actually.
It does. That's it does. Good. That's
Yeah. Reassuring.
It was
a smooth transition for her into...
Actually, it was GSA's... budget director who said it best about federal technology, that the philosophy is often, if it ain't broke, don't make it better.
Yeah.
And I understand, right? Because it's working, right? It's working badly, but it's working, which is better than maybe what Right. It was before, which wasn't working. Or, you know, there was that time that guy got fired. Well, they probably didn't get fired, they got moved, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
The point is that if it's working, I'm not going to be the guy who takes the risk, or I can't get the appropriation to make the change, or and then what happens is you miss successive generations of improvements. And while maybe it worked for Sunny in Hawaii, it can get awfully expensive to replace that green screen system. Or if people have been making the same muscle movements for 30 years, it's really hard to get them to change. And I think what's happened, you describe it really well, as these are 7 years old.
Yeah.
You know, my teenagers have said that they would die if they didn't have them. So clearly it's become an organ for some part of our population. But we are still under the if it ain't broke, don't fix it mentality, don't make it better mentality. So you're running into this huge disconnect, an expectation of the way basic services should be delivered, and then just the way we deliver the basic services. And so I think really the question is, how do we encourage people to make experiments within the business process? We have this tendency to say, okay, well, if we're going to fix this process, we're going to fix it for everyone at all, in all cases, all on the same day. We know how that works out sometimes, right? On this day, everyone will do it this way.
Yeah.
That's exactly what won't happen.
There's not a lot of A/B testing
exactly
in the
right.
federal immigration
and
process.
So that's what we have to do, is we have to figure out ways to do that within the constraints of the law, because there is the whole notion of equal protection, and so we want to make sure that you're not treating people differently here than there, but at some level that's kind of what we have to do
right.
in order to experiment. I think what we have to recognize is that this world has changed. It's changed very dramatically and suddenly for a lot of people, and we have to figure out ways that we can kind of encourage them, bring them in. I think that's part of the idea behind 18F as well, is to give people an opportunity somewhere that they can go, where we can try stuff out, we can experiment with things, we can see how it works on a small scale, figure out how you can make it a bigger scale, and then go back to the broader community and say, okay, help us deliver this bigger solution. But I would say, rather than looking at it purely from a standpoint of deficit, I'd say it's actually a huge opportunity, and why it's a particularly exciting time to work in the federal government. And that's really, the fundamental pitch that I use for anyone who's we're trying to bring inbound, is to say, look, it's kind of hard, it's a little messy. There's lots of places that are screwed up. But isn't that a great opportunity for someone then to make a big difference?
Imagine the hero that says, instead of sending the same photos of me and my fiance into the State Department over and over again, just says, give me access to your Instagram feed. And how transformative
I'm
that
taking
can
that down. I'm going to write that idea down.
I actually ran out of photos after a while. Yeah. We talked about 18F. Talk about the Presidential Innovation Fellows Program. Why is that important?
So I think the Presidential Innovations Fellows Program is important because it really is an opportunity for us to have that dialogue in places maybe we weren't having the dialogue before as to why it's interesting, exciting, and important for people to get involved in their government. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing to sit back and complain about it and to say, you know, what you would do if you were in charge. It's another thing to actually come in and walk a mile in the shoes and see what it's actually like to try to get it done.
All right, hotshot. Go at it.
Yeah, exactly right. Oh, you're so smart. There you go. What's really great, though, actually, is the reception that the PIFs have received in the agencies. Mm-hmm. There's a sense that that together, you know, there's a co-investment in trying to solve the problem. And I think it's been really energizing for the people in the agencies who have worked with the PIFs, as well as the PIFs. And a third of the PIFs have stayed on in some capacity in the federal government. Now, these are folks who've said that I'm dropping this important thing or this lucrative thing or this thing over in California. I'm going to come. I'm going to do a year and a half of service and, make a difference and then go back. And a third of them have just fallen in love with the opportunity and the challenge and, frankly, the mission. Mm-hmm. And I think at a fundamental level, that's our stock options, is the fact that we have ability to impact hundreds of millions of people and make this country a better place.
We had a round table at 1776 recently with one of the senior leaders from McKinsey. We had a bunch of our startup founders around the table, and we talked about a bunch of stuff. And towards the end, one of the startups said, let me ask a dumb question, but why do all these big, giant corporations that McKinsey advises, why are they so oblivious? And they were asking in a really interesting way, because these startups come along with these disruptive models that can be existentially threatening to these big organizations, and they're really loud about it. And they're like,
right,
giving advance notice for years.
I'm coming after you.
And right, like investors and everybody is like, oh, well, so-and-so is just going to crush you, but they don't.
Right.
Right. They don't. They don't adapt very fast. And it was fascinating because the McKinsey leader said, let me describe what my life in McKinsey is like. And it's not that different from a senior executive's in any organization, which is that more than half my time is taken up with expense reports and budget requests and
this is reassuring.
Performance reviews and organizational charts. And they said, I spend maybe 5 or 10% of my time actually thinking about the future of my business, right? These startups are myopically focused on transforming that. So when these Presidential Innovation Fellows come into this environment, right, how do you get them out of that sort of world in which, yeah, they're really innovative before, but all of their time just gets sucked up into all this stuff that sustains the bureaucracy rather than really moves things forward?
Well, I think part of it is actually having them as a cadre, so having a support network. Mm-hmm. We learned actually in the first round that also finding agency sponsors, people within the organization who are going to be help them navigate the agencies. I think it's great actually to have people who don't have all the ingrained experiences of what it's like to work in the agency ask the question, why do you do it this way? It's like the three-year-old. You turn the three-year-old loose and why? And after the third why, you're like, I have no idea why.
it's just because.
And I think that's been a big part of the learning at 18F too, is you just keep pulling that string, the why string, and then it comes down to that there isn't a law, policy, or regulation there. It's just habit. And habits are, well, they're not easy to change, but they don't require an act of Congress to change. So I think that's actually part of the wonder of bringing the folks in, but it's only about 30 people. And so we have to think about ways that we can scale the attraction process,
right,
into the federal government. We have to think about ways that we can make it easier for people who are interested and engaged in this broader mission to serve for some time, either a year or 23, like I have. And I think that we have to figure out ways that we encourage people, bring them in, and then support them in the way that we have the PIF program. I think, you know, a group like ACT-IAC is a form of that kind of a support mechanism. It's people trading stories about how they got it done or what they ran into or are there walls you can come over. And that's the benefit of this kind of group, and that's the benefit of having a PIF cohort.
So let me ask and I want to come back to how do we attract talent, millennials, and
sure.
all that stuff, but let me ask sort of a provocative question. We have the benefit, we look at thousands of startups a year all around the world. You have the benefit as you look at sort of the pattern recognition of what sort of tends to work and what doesn't. And one of the rules you sort of figure out after a while as an investor is we would be extremely unlikely to invest in a startup that was outsourcing its development. Mm-hmm. Because startups that outsource the development just move much slower, and the ability to sort of connect up what the customer needs with what's being built is just so much more attenuated. And startups in which development is really tightly coupled with the people that are really understanding the customer just do much, much, much better, much higher rates of success. When you look at the sort of evolution of stuff, it feels like there continues to be sort of an assumption or bias in the federal government that anything that needs to be built has to be built by a vendor. Is that changing? Should that change? What's the role that 18F, the PIFs, are sort of playing in part of that transition and change?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there will be a long-standing, continuous role for high-quality vendors in the federal government. That we need that. That's where we're going to continually get exposed to the innovation. What's interesting to me is that the federal government actually is in two different camps in this area. In some cases, we just have completely outsourced all the thinking about the process. We've turned it into a contracting exercise rather than a programmatic partnership exercise about delivering an outcome. In other places, we have some of the most innovative, thoughtful developers that there are, period. If you look at the Department of Defense, if you look at the Department of Energy, there are really, really smart, talented folks doing stuff that is transformative, that, you know, NASA, that is, you know, that industry is chasing mm-hmm. and trying to copy and trying to learn from. So how do we apply that full spectrum of the places where we're the best and the places where we could be better to raise the quality overall? We think it's actually going to require agencies to think more about their IT shops as less about the pipes and wires, the utility services and contracting, and more about having at least some cadre within each IT shop who understands how systems are built, who understands how to build a minimally viable product, who understands how to do the testing. And that's, to some extent, what we've been trying to demonstrate with 18F. It's a small group of people. You know, they're not going to replace the important relationships we have with contractors going forward. They're going to enhance our ability to actually be a better consumer of those services.
So you actually, you came and visited 1776, which is awesome. Spent
yes.
some time with our startups.
You don't want to know this, but I also visited, 1871 in Chicago.
Yeah. Big, good partners of ours.
It's another number in Denver. It's Catalyst in Denver.
There's Galvanized. There's Galvanized.
Someone should call one Catalyst, by the way. But anyway.
Lots of our great partners. But the environment, right, is about as radically, like the physical feel of the space, right? The environment's about as radically different from walking into a typical federal agency
okay,
as you could imagine.
Typical, but I don't know. Come to 1800. I don't know. Have you visited 1800?
I haven't. I think Catherine.
It's a one-way street. No, anyway. But you should come visit the GSA headquarters and see what we've tried to do there is to dramatically transform the way even federal agencies lay themselves out. I had a deputy secretary come through on a tour, and we've had a number of secretaries view. I joke, everyone in 1800F now knows what it's like to be an exhibit at the Smithsonian Museum. We have so many people coming through. I had a deputy secretary say, wow, this does not look like a federal agency.
Right.
And he's like, and I don't mean that to be, you know, a federal building. He's like, I don't mean that to be insulting. And I'm like, I am a little insulted that we don't actually have an expectation that every federal agency could look like a modern operating entity. And what we've done there is really say, let's make the space less a reflection of hierarchy and org structure, and let's make the space, frankly, more conducive to collaboration and cooperation. 80% of the seats in GSA headquarters are not assigned, and you have to register up to 2 weeks in advance of where you're going to sit. The great thing about that is it kind of democratizes freedom of movement. So if I'm kind of tired of sitting next to you, I can go sit somewhere else. But if I, actually there's value for us sitting together, say you're in the budget office and I'm in the IT shop and we're trying to put together a justification for, you know, this modernization of a system, we can actually come together. We can actually schedule ourselves to sit near each other. By pulling down the walls, the physical barriers in the building, we're creating much more opportunity for people to share ideas, to communicate, to bump into each other. And in that way, I think we're beginning to demonstrate, hopefully, a broader model of kind of agility of doing everything we do, not just agility in designing IT systems, but agility in getting budgets built and in people hired.
So if we pull that thread just a little bit further, so we talked earlier about starting to think as sort of one government, not a whole bunch of siloed entities. Now you're talking within GSA about the physical,
right,
changing of the physical environment, inducing collaboration across different parts of GSA. Does every government agency need its own building or its own sort of physical space?
That's very funny. I mean, this is a question that's been asked and answered back in the Johnson administration when they were building federal buildings. The federal office building, the idea was to build this big federal office building, put the agencies together. It was to make it more efficient for the customer interaction, but it was also so that agencies could share certain utilities like security, conference rooms, dining facilities. What happened over the 80s and 90s is we got away from it. We really focused on the individual agency as a specific, very unique entity that had its own building requirements. And I've been in hundreds of federal buildings now. I'm having a really hard time describing. I would have a hard time describing why one is so unique that it's very different than that one, and they need to be separated. There are differing security requirements, but push the ones with the certain kind of security requirements together. Push the ones that have a real customer focus together. We actually think that you could be more liquid with the space. We've invited as many as 20 people from any agency who wants to try the 1800F experience to come over and live in the wild with us, you know, gorillas in the mist, like. We'll give you laptops, we'll connect you to your IT system, and you can experience it. We actually think this idea of the federal office building giving way to kind of common federal space is an inevitability. I don't know when it's going to happen, but...
I know we've actually explored this idea a little bit, but I like this sort of almost radical idea of like when you have excess federal space, even
yes,
letting some of these crazy startups that we work with come in and collaborate, really drive that information transfer in different ways.
Yeah, we want to be certainly aware of, you know, ethics and procurement limitations, but that's usually the way people start a conversation when they don't want to even think about it anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, look, it's getting awfully close to lunchtime. Let me just give you the limitations so we can stop talking.
Yeah. That's hard, so
yeah,
there's
right,
got to be a rule
exactly
against it.
Right. And actually, we have expansive authorities for outlease and for co-location. So the question is, if we do that, do we have to do it with us being completely evacuated out of the building? Could we share space? Could there be opportunities for that? We've talked to SBA and NEC mm-hmm. about the idea of, you know, leveraging federal space or federal office space for that purpose. There are security concerns, but those are, you know, my view is it's really more of a challenge to be solved rather than a problem that will prevent us from actually getting there.
But massive potential opportunities
massive
for sort of driving culture change.
I completely agree.
So we've got about 10 minutes left, and I've got some more questions for you, but wanted to see if we want to open up to the audience for some questions real quick. All right.
No, here's one here.
Hi, Debbie Granberry with CSC. So I asked this question last year, and I'm going to ask it in a little different way, because...
Did you get a good answer?
No. Oh. Because I think it's really hard stuff. So
strike one, okay.
We've been talking about, you know, CIOs having the authority to do the things that they really need to do. And some of it is authority, some of it is leadership, because it's nice to talk about email systems, but when you really get down to understanding what really drives mission delivery in the organizations, it's truly applications. And we never seem to get there with applications. We're always talking about infrastructure or, you know, commodity IT, et cetera. So that's one question. And then you put that together with your conversation around risk and agencies being able to take acquisition decisions and put risk in a way that you can, so transitions, for example. So if I have to transition something and I'm going to compete against others who aren't there already is a big risk. And in a lot of ways, that negates an agency's willingness to really take a look at where they could be in the future because of that risk, and because that risk isn't compared favorably across multiple solutions that are being provided. So those two things together, because I think when you start talking about really delivering to the citizen the kind of mission services that we need to, of course you've got to have robust enterprise infrastructures and email so that you can talk, but the heart of that is the application.
Give them a little time to answer. We only have...
Yeah, no.
We've got to answer all that in 40 seconds, by
the way. Yeah, and I'm worried I'm going to not do a good job again. Let me just say on the issue of CIO authority, I think the problem is the CIOs end up leveraging whatever authority they have into the utility rather than into the mission critical application. That having been said, I don't know if I want CIOs to be the authority on mission critical applications. That really belongs to the program. They should be an enabler. So we have to be really careful that we don't hand all that responsibility over to the CIO, who really isn't the program expert. On this idea then of bringing new approaches in, I think part of the problem you run into is you described the transition in a way that is a big bang transition, an all-in transition. And if you're going to do a big bang, all-in transition, chances are you are going to try to mitigate risk by finding something. Who said it? You want to be the third or the fifth agency, preferably the 23rd, that does it, right? Because even if it does go bad, you can say, well, you know, I had 22 other people ahead of me. And I think the trick then is, how do you break those transitions into smaller transitions and experiment with other opportunities so that you can see whether it's going to deliver the outcome or not. But that then comes back to a acquisition philosophy that's really focused on an outcome that isn't simply a risk mitigating outcome, but an outcome, one that's focused on the best possible outcomes. Did I get closer this year, or do I have to come back next?
Great.
Oh, okay.
I think one more question from the audience over here.
Hi.
Uh-oh, it's a plant. Hi, Greg.
Hello. Yeah. Nice to meet you. I'm Greg at 18F.
Really?
So this is a little bit of a softball, but you talked a little bit about mission, and government has plenty of mission. Throughout the weekend, I've heard a trend of conversations mostly about how do we create the environment to get people in, and then, of course, earlier there was a discussion about millennials. And for a group, 18F, who has a majority of millennials working there, if you could share a little bit the discussions we've had, particularly around autonomy and enabling or empowering, because that's come up in other meetings, and I'd like for you to sort of wrap that up so other people can hear that.
It's fascinating that the only two people in the room without jackets on are me and the guy from 18F.
Right, right. Well, you know, last year I came, and I didn't have a tie, and I felt like I was... I don't know, pariah. So I joke that on the West Coast, I'm always overdressed, and on the East Coast, I'm underdressed, and somehow I've managed to you know, get it wrong today too. So anyway, on the idea of attracting, you know, millennials, I actually think the bigger challenge is how do we hire them once we attract them, to be perfectly honest. And the federal hiring program for incoming employees is one that really needs additional attention and focus. We have been able to find paths through that, but they've not been easy paths. They've been hard. Greg is happy to meet you at the bar and tell you long stories about them later on. But I really think the trick is, you know, how do you get people excited about the work in federal government? You really have to think about ways that we approach that work. I think it's Dan Pink in Drive who says there are three things that people, knowledge workers, are looking for in their jobs, and that's mission, mastery, and autonomy. I like to say about mission, we've got that to burn, and we've got mission in big stacks laying around. The leaders of our organizations need to remember that we have a massively important, significant, and impactful mission. This idea that at every day at GSA, we're enabling agencies that protect the border and keep planes a safe distance from each other, our food safe, and people continuing to experiment to find cures for things like cancer, that's an incredibly powerful and meaningful mission, and we shouldn't be shy about talking about it. Mastery is, you know, is finding those people who do have that talent and ability, attracting, you know, the coder to come actually work on code, and finding ways that we can continually reinvest folks by letting them participating in events like this or network with other agency partners or, you know, visit 1776. And then autonomy is really, someone referred to this idea of trusting your employees to actually be focused on that mission and leverage that skill that they have to get great outcomes. And I think if we can adopt those three principles in everything we do, then we're going to have no trouble actually attracting people to the work. The question you have to ask yourself as leaders when you go back to where you work, are you really giving people those opportunities to leverage their mastery? Are you giving them the autonomy to deliver on that mission? And I think that that's our responsibility as leaders in this field, to ask ourselves every day when we go to work, how can we provide that environment?
Well, it's not a long-term question either. I mean, I think I read recently that by 2020, 50% of the U.S. workforce will be millennials.
Right.
This is the largest cohort in American history, and it's very rapidly taking over the workforce. So if you can't figure out how to unlock the potential of this generation, you're really limiting your potential.
It's inevitable. Eventually, you know, they'll find their way into the right position and they'll start changing the agency or the operation. The question is, are we going to wait? Are we going to be patient? Are we going to have a sense of urgency and a real sense of mission and say, you know, maybe this world has changed, you know? Maybe something happened in the last 7 years that is radically different than anything that had happened in the 7 years before. And perhaps we have to really rethink the way we physically lay ourselves out, organize ourselves, even resource ourselves.
So as a wrap-up, because I know we're getting the cut sign,
yeah.
What are some of the things you're kind of personally directly doing in, from a leadership standpoint, kind of cultivating this next generation of leaders?
Well, I think really what we're trying to do is create an environment that that everyone feels at home in, that is more about collaboration and less about hierarchy, that's more about outcome, and less about a devotion to process. Process is not the end. And it's striking how often times that the discussion is really about process as the end. What we need to do is continually remind ourselves that the outcome is the end. We're trying to deliver a service. We're trying to make an improvement. We're trying to find value or savings. And the process is just the means we get there. We need to actually adopt this idea of continuous process improvement, continually looking at the way we deliver these outcomes and ask ourselves, can it be faster? Can it be cheaper? Can it be better?
Excellent.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
It's a lot of fun.
Thank you. Thanks, Evan.
Appreciate
it very much. Thanks a lot. Thanks so much. Thank you.